content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Today we have a special article entitled American Civilization. And this was written by Ralph Waldo Emerson for the April of 1862 issue of the magazine. And this is a very long article, and I will be reading half of it this episode, and I will read the second half on the next episode. Just as a reminder, The Atlantic magazine was founded in 1857 in Boston as The Atlantic Monthly, a literary and cultural magazine that published leading writers' commentary on education and the abolition of slavery and other major political issues of that time. Its founders included Francis H. Underwood and prominent writers Ralph Waldo Emerson, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and John Greenleaf Whittier. James Russell Lowell was its first editor. So, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote an argument in which he was upset with the Civil War as it was continuing onward. He argued vehemently for a federal emancipation of the slaves. Above all, he asserted, morality is the object of government. A certain degree of progress from the rudest state in which man is found, a dweller in caves or on trees like an ape, a cannibal, an eater of pounded snails, worms, and offal, a certain degree of progress from this extreme is called civilization. It is a vague, complex name of many degrees. Nobody has attempted a definition. Mr. Guizot, writing a book on the subject, does not. It implies the evolution of a highly organized man, brought to supreme delicacy of sentiment, as in practical power, religion, liberty, sense of honor, and taste. In the hesitation to define what it is, we usually suggest it by negations. A nation that has no clothing, no alphabet, no iron, no marriage, no arts of peace, no abstract thought, we call barbarous. And after many arts are invented or imported, as among the Turks and Moorish nations, it is often a little complacent to call them civilized. Each nation grows after its own genius and has a civilization of its own. The Chinese and Japanese, though each complete in his way, is different from the man of Madrid or the man of New York. The term imports a mysterious progress. In the brutes, it is none. And in mankind, the savage tribes do not advance. The Indians of this country have not learned the white man's work. And in Africa, the Negro of today is the Negro of Herodotus. But in other races, the growth is not arrested. But the like progress that is made by a boy, when he cuts his eye teeth, as we say, childish illusions to passing daily away, and he seeing things really and comprehensively, is made by tribes. It is learning the secret of cumulative power, of advancing on oneself. It implies a facility of association, power to compare, the ceasing from fixed ideas. The Indian is gloomy and distressed when urged to depart from his habits and traditions. He is overpowered by the gaze of the white, and his eyes sinks. The occasion of one of these starts of growth is always some novelty that astounds the mind and provokes it to dare to change. Thus there is a Manco Capac at the beginning of each improvement. Some foreign, superior foreigner importing new and wonderful arts and teaching them. Of course, he must not know too much, but must have the sympathy, language, and gods of those he would inform. But chiefly the seashore has been the point of departure to knowledge as to commerce. The most advanced nations are always those who navigate the most. The power which the sea requires in the sailor makes a man of him very fast. And the change of shores and population clears his head of much nonsense of his wigwam. Where shall we begin or end the list of those feats of liberty and wit, each of which feats made an epoch of history? Thus the effect of a framed or stone house is immense on the tranquility, power, and refinement of the builder. A man in a cave or in a camp, a nomad, will die with no more estate than the wolf or the horse leaves. But so simple a labor as a house being achieved, his chief enemies are kept at bay. He is safe from the teeth of wild animals, from frost, sunstroke, and weather, and fine faculties begin to yield their fine harvest. Invention and art are born, manners and social beauty and delight. 'Tis a wonderful how soon a piano gets into the log hut of the frontier. You would think they found it under a pine stump. When it comes to a Latin grammar, and one of those towhead boys has written a hymn on Sunday. Now let colleges, now let senates take heed, for here is one who, opening these fine tastes on the basis of the pioneer's iron constitution, will gather all their laurels in his strong hands. When the Indian trail gets widened, graded, and bridged to a good road, there is a benefactor, there is a missionary, a pacificator, a wealth bringer, a maker of markets, a vent for industry. The building 300 or 400 miles of road in the Scotch Highlands in the 1626 to 1649 eventually tamed the ferocious clans and established public order. Another step of civility is the change from war, hunting, and pasturage to agriculture. Our Scandinavian forefathers have left us a significant legend to convey their sense of the importance of this step. There was once a giantess who had a daughter, and the child saw a husbandman plowing in the field. Then she ran and picked him up with her finger and thumb, and put him and his plow and his oxen into her apron, and carried them to her mother, and said, "Mother, what sort of beetle is this that I found wriggling in the sand?" But the mother said, "Put it away, my child. We must be gone out of this land, for these people will dwell in it." Another success is the post office, with its educating energy, augmented by cheapness, and guarded by a certain religious sentiment in mankind, so that the power of a wafer or a drop of wax or gluten to guard a letter, as it flies over sea, over land, and comes to its address as if a battalion of artillery brought it, I look upon as a fine meter of civilization. The division of labor, the multiplication of the arts of peace, which is nothing but a large allowance to each man to choose his work according to his faculty, to live by his better hand, fills the state with useful and happy laborers, and they, creating demand by the very temptation of their productions, are rapidly and surely rewarded by good sale. And what a police and Ten Commandments their work thus becomes. So true is Dr. Johnson's remark that, quote, men are seldom more innocently employed than when they are making money, end quote. The skillful combinations of civil government, though they usually follow natural leadings, as the lines of race, language, religion, and territory, yet require wisdom and conduct in the rulers, and in their result delight the imagination. We see insurmountable multitudes obeying, in opposition to their strongest passions, the restraints of power which they scarcely perceive and the crimes of a single individual marked and punished at the distance of half the earth. Right position of woman in the state is another index. Poverty and industry with a healthy mind read very easily the laws of humanity and love them. Place the sexes in right relations of mutual respect, and a severe morality gives that essential charm to woman which educates all that is delicate, poetic, and self-sacrificing, breeds courtesy and learning, conversation and wit in her rough mate. So that I have thought it a sufficient definition of civilization to say it is the influence of a good woman. Another measure of culture is the diffusion of knowledge, overrunning all the old barriers of caste, and, by the cheap press, bringing the university to every poor man's door in the newsboy's basket. Scraps of science, of thought, of poetry are in the coarsest sheet, so that every house we hesitate to tear a newspaper until we have looked it through. The ship, in its latest complete equipment, is an abridgment and compend of the nation's arts. The ship steered by compass and chart, longitude reckoned by lunar observation, and when the heavens are hid by chronometer, driven by steam, and in the wildest sea mountains, at vast distances from home. No use can lessen the wonder of this control. So, by so weak a creature, of forces so prodigious. I remember I watched, in crossing the sea, the beautiful skill whereby the engine, in its constant working, was made to produce 200 gallons of fresh water out of salt water every hour, thereby supplying all the ship's want. The skill that pervades complex details, the man that maintains himself, the chimney taught to burn its own smoke, the farm made to produce all that is consumed on it, the very prison compelled to maintain itself and yield a revenue, and, better than that, made a reform school and a manufactory of honest men out of rogues, as the steamer made fresh water out of salt. All these are examples of that tendency to combine antagonisms and utilize evil, which is the index of high civilization. Civilization is the result of highly complex organization. In the snake, all the organs are sheathed. No hands, no feet, no fins, no wings. In bird and beast, the organs are released and begin to play. In man, they are all unbound and full of joyful action. With this unswaddling, he receives the absolute illumination we call reason, and thereby true liberty. Climate has much to do with this melioration. The highest civility has never loved the hot zones. Wherever snow falls, there is usually civil freedom. Where the banana grows, the animal system is indolent and pampered at the cost of higher qualities. The man is grasping, sensual, and cruel. But this scale is by no means invariable. For high degrees of moral sentiment control the unfavorable influences of climate, and some of our grandest examples of men and of races come from the equatorial regions, as the genius of Egypt, of India, and of Arabia. These feats are measures or traits of civility, and temperate climate is an important influence, though not quite indispensable, for there have been learning, philosophy, and art in Ireland and in the tropics. But one condition is essential to the social education of man, namely morality. There can be no high civility without a deep morality, though it may not always call itself by that name. But sometimes the point of honor, as in the institution of chivalry or patriotism, as in the Spartan and Roman republics, or the enthusiasm of some religious sect which imputes its virtue to its dogma, or the Kabbalism or esprit de corps of a Masonic or other association of friends. The evolution of a highly destined society must be moral. It must run in the grooves of the celestial wheels. It must be Catholic, small c, in Ames. What is moral? It is the respecting of action, Catholic, or universal ends. Hear the definition which Kant gives of moral conduct. Quote, act always so that the immediate motive of thy will may become a universal rule for all intelligent beings. End quote. Civilization depends on morality. Everything good in man leans on what is higher. This rule holds in small as in great. Thus, all our strength and success in the work of our hands depends on the borrowing the aid of the elements. You have seen a carpenter on a ladder with a broad axe chopping upward chips and slivers from the beam. How awkward, at what disadvantage he works. But see him on the ground, dressing his timber under him. Now, not his feeble muscles, but the force of gravity brings down the axe. That is to say, the planet itself splits his stick. The farmer had much ill temper, laziness, and shirking to endure from his hand sawers, until one day he bethought him to put his sawmill on the edge of a waterfall, and the river never tires of turning his wheel. The river is good-natured and never hints of objection. We had letters to send. Couriers could not go fast enough, nor far enough. Broke their wagons, foundered their horses. Bad roads in spring, snowdrifts in winter, heats in summer. Could not get the horses out of a walk. But we found out that the air and earth were full of electricity, and it was always going our way, just the way we wanted to send. Would he take a message? Just as lief as not. Had nothing to do with it. Would carry it in no time. Only one doubt occurred, one staggering objection. He had no carpet bag, no visible pockets, no hands, not so much as a mouth, to carry a letter. But after much thought and many experiments, we managed to meet the conditions and to fold up the letter in such an invisible compact form as he could carry it in those invisible pockets of his, never wrought by needle and thread, and it went like a charm. I admire still more than the sawmill the skill which, on the seashore, makes the tides drive the wheels and grind corn, and which thus embraces the assistance of the moon, like a hired band, to grind and wind and pump and saw and split stone and roll iron. Now that it is the wisdom of a man in every instance of his labor to hitch his wagon to a star, to see his chore done by the gods themselves. That is the way we are strong, by borrowing the might of the elements, the forces of steam, gravity, galvanism, light, magnets, wind, fire, serves us day by day and costs us nothing. Our astronomy is full of examples of calling in the aid of these magnificent helpers. Thus, on a planet so small as ours, the want of an adequate base for astronomical measurements is early felt, as, for example, in detecting the parallax of a star. But the astronomer, having an observation, fixed the place of a star, so by simple an expedient as waiting 6 months, and then repeating his observation, contrived to put the diameter of the Earth's orbit, say 200 millions of miles, between his first observation and his second, and this line afforded him a respectable base for his triangle. I am going to stop here with this article, a very lengthy article. As I noted that in the beginning, Ralph Waldo Emerson was writing to argue against emancipation of the slaves, and he's barely gotten there yet, so we'll read the rest of this next time. Today's second article is entitled The Hollow Men, written by George Packer. In George Orwell's 1984, at the climax of Hate Week, Oceania is suddenly no longer at war with Eurasia, but instead is at war with East Asia, and always has been. The pivot comes with no explanation or even announcement. During a public harangue, a party orator is handed a scrap of paper and redirects his vitriol mid-sentence, not only without a pause, but without even breaking the syntax. Republican politicians in Donald Trump's inner party faced similar verbal challenge when the president changed sides in Russia's war against Ukraine. One morning in late February, Republicans in Washington greeted Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky as a hero for continuing to resist Russian aggression. By afternoon, following Zelensky's meeting in the Oval Office with Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance, the Ukrainian leader was an ungrateful, troublesome, and badly dressed warmonger who, if he hadn't actually started the conflict with Russia, was the only obstacle to ending it. After this new line was communicated to party leaders, pro-Zelensky social media post was taken down as swiftly as the banners denouncing Eurasia. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, and Senator Lindsey Graham, all supporters of Ukraine, were sent out in front of the cameras like the Hate Week orator, not to explain a new policy, but to pretend that nothing had changed while America switched sides. Using nearly identical language, Rubio, Johnson, and Graham declared that Zelensky must do Trump's bidding, which is also Vladimir Putin's bidding, to capitulate to Russia. Otherwise, Johnson and Graham added, Zelensky should resign. America's enemy isn't Russia. America's enemy is Ukraine. The philosopher Henry Bergson observed, the attitudes, gestures, and movements of the human body are laughable in exact proportion, as that body reminds us of a mere machine. The cause of laughter is the, quote, deflection of life toward the mechanical, end quote. This insight explains why there is something comical about politicians when they substitute programmed language for speech that reflects actual thought. They are besuited contraptions, like another orthodoxy-spouting ideologue in 1984, whose spectacles catch the light and seem to render him eyeless while his jaw keeps moving, as if this was not a real human being but some kind of dummy. Having emptied themselves of the capacity or will for independent judgment, they become extremely fluent automatons, able to put together the whole paragraphs of logical-sounding arguments, but with no connection between brain and mouth. Every politician is required to speak like a robot some of the time. It takes a special talent to betray an entire worldview without missing a beat. Graham's mechanical style is to flit almost gleefully from one position to its opposite while remaining a party insider, which is his only consistent position and justification for all his others. Johnson stares through his glasses and gropes for the appropriate words, with the unease of a simple man trying to not to screw up his lines. I can tell you that we are re-exerting peace through strength. President Trump has brought back strength to the White House. We knew that this moment would come. We worked hard for it to come, and now it's here. Rubio is a more complex case. He sat mute through the entire Oval Office blow-up, while his principles almost visibly escaped his body, causing it to sink deeper into the yellow sofa. Having made his name in the Senate as a passionate defender of democracy and adversity of authoritarianism, he must have suffered more than the others from the inner contortions demanded by the new party line. They were written on his unhappy face. But Rubio had already begun the process of mechanizing himself weeks before, when he shut down foreign aid programs that he had always supported. Reappearing in public after the meeting with Zelensky, he denounced the Ukrainian president with the overzealous exasperation of a successfully hollowed policymaker. When a leader requires his underlings to say what they know isn't true, up is down, Oceania has always been at war with East Asia, Ukraine is to blame. It's a test of loyalty and a show of dominance. Ritualized humiliation is essential to an authoritarian regime. Trump forces aides, advisors, and the friendly press that he allows into the room to utter absurdities on his behalf in order to bind them closer to him, and thereby frees himself from any restraint. They know from example of more courageous and less careful colleagues that any quiver of independence will doom them politically and perhaps even harm them physically. Almost immediately, it seems, they cease to be troubled by conscience or even motivated by fear. As they become more machine-like, they forget that they ever held a different idea or any idea at all. You can see it in their relaxed features and smoother delivery. Trump alone is allowed to say what he thinks. There's nothing laughably mechanical about his abandonment of Ukraine, Europe, and American leadership of the free world. He doesn't embrace Russia like an eyeless dummy. He never sounded more natural or truer to himself than when he told Zelensky of his bond of sympathy with Putin and mocked the Ukrainian president for the agony that Russia has inflicted on his country. And if, a week or two later, American policy on the war flipped again, it wasn't because Trump's worldview changed. He still prefers dictators and wants to be one of them. It only meant that the leader can declare that Oceania is at war with East Asia or Eurasia on any given day. At least from the time he was 5 years old and, according to Maggie Haberman's biography, Confidence Man, threw rocks at a baby in a playpen, Trump has admired strength and despised weakness. Terms used by Ukrainians' defenders, such as sovereignty, democracy, and shared values, obviously disgust him, because they're the language of the weak. For Trump, strength has nothing to do with the classical virtues of nobility and courage. It's the raw power to humiliate others, whether a person or a country. Zelensky's physical and moral courage, including his refusal to be belittled on camera in the Oval Office, enrages Trump, for he's accustomed to endless subservience and flattery. Trump's decision in March to halt the flow of arms and intelligence to Ukraine doesn't follow a foreign policy of isolationism. When Vance, running for a U.S. Senate seat in Ohio in 2022, said, quote, "I really don't care what happens to Ukraine one way or the other," he was expressing an isolationist sentiment. This indifference falls well short of Trump's contempt for Zelensky and long-standing attraction to Putin. Trump wants Russia to win and Ukraine to lose. A poll in early March by the civic organization More in Common shows that Americans haven't abandoned all the values that Trump and his sycophants are trashing. Nearly two-thirds of respondents still sympathize with Ukraine, and more want to continue arming it. Even among Republicans, the majority believe that Russia is to blame for the war and considered Putin a dictator. Support for Russia is in the low single digits. The survey shows that years of propaganda and lies from Trump and the MAGA right have failed to poison the body politic with cynicism. Although the elites in power insist that might makes right and that Oceania has always been at war with East Asia, most ordinary Americans haven't yet thrown away a worldview of true and false, right and wrong. They might be America's last best hope. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-8255.